Beautiful early morning. Welcome to On the Brink Radio, broadcast number 302. I'm recording this from Montague, Tasmania, in the far northwest corner, almost as far as you can go without going out to some of the islands, the Hunter Group, the Florio Group, the Kent Group of islands, some of the 108 objects sticking up out of the ocean between Tasmania in the mainland of southern Australia. I'm looking out the window of a beautiful art studio where I've been staying for the past few days, seeing some beautiful friends of mine. My great friend Craig Gabo Garland, who's a legendary Tasmanian fisherman and environmental activist and political activist in recent years due to his concern about some really pressing environmental issues. I've learned a lot about some of the issues affecting this part of Tasmania specifically. I'm looking out right now, and on the northwestern horizon, I can see a place called Cape Grim, which I believe was named by James Cook. The organizations who measure air and water quality have stations up there, and it's consensus that the air and water quality measured at Cape Grim is the cleanest in the entire world, and it's had a reputation for that for a really long time. So it's really lovely to be in a place like this, and I've spent a lot of time on Flinders Island, Tasmania, which is off the northeast coast. And so this is the first time I've been up this far for more than just a couple hours. And it's very similar. But there's these really, really cool black rocks that must be of volcanic origin on the beach that I haven't seen anywhere else in Tasmania. But along the Cape Grim horizon, it's probably about 50 kilometers from here, I can see these giant wind turbines turning in the wind, because this area is known for extreme and continuous wind, sort of like the Patagonia of Australia. But a company called UPC, which, believe it or not, is Chinese owned, but it's registered as an Australian corporation, they're getting ready to install what would be one of the largest wind farms in the southern hemisphere on Robbins Island, which is where I'm looking at right now across the channel, not more than a kilometer, 1 or 2 kilometers from where I'm sitting right now. And these towers, there's probably going to be hundreds of them, and each one's going to be 273 meters tall. That's meters, not feet. So the northwest horizon and view that I'm looking at right now, if this project goes ahead, it's going to be dominated by these giant things that are going to stick up taller than some of the trees in the foreground that I'm seeing, and probably make noise that's audible from here. So this show, On the Brink Radio number 302, it's called Geoterrorism and the Atlantean Discontinuity. But before I get into today's show, I'd like to honor my mom and dad, who on this day, I believe today or tomorrow, which is almost the anniversary of the assassination of JFK, my mom and dad were in a very serious car accident back in North Carolina, and my mom was killed instantly, and my dad lived a few more days in and out of consciousness, but I was in Darwin, Northern Territory, and preparing to travel down the West Coast, and it was a profoundly and extraordinarily traumatic much more so for them than for me, but wanted to honor my mom and dad as the most beautiful parents anybody could ever have. And I love them and send blessings for them on their journey around the galaxies. And I know I'll see them again, and also send blessings on other friends of mine and people I've known who have undergone the coming forth by day journey in recent months, including my very dear friend Rob Alliston, who actually grew up on Three Hummock Island, or what used to be called East Hunter Island here, which is really what brought me here to catch up with Craig for the first time in 10 years to begin with, to try to get out to Three Hummock Island in honor of Rob. So, Rob Alliston, my friend the Jacques Cousteau of New Zealand, Wade Doak, who passed away a few months ago, my very dear friend Bruce Watson of California, who is a musician friend of mine who passed away just about 2 weeks ago after I was able to have a really beautiful Skype session with him and played him some flute and some music and stuff. It's a journey that we're all on, coming forth by day. To the ancient Egyptians meant waking up. And so I reckon that we can all have the possibility of coming forth by day while we're still inhabiting our physical temple, our body. I think that's the ultimate goal of spiritual realization, is to wake up as fully as possible without dying. In a very important and brilliant book called Angels Don't Play This Harp, that's H-A-A-R-P, that stands for the High Altitude Auroral Research Project, written by doctors Nick Begich and Gene Manning in 1992 or 1993. This book and this research represents one of the greatest efforts and successful missions of investigative journalism in the history of investigative journalism, but especially in terms of modern science. Because it's almost as if Nick Begich, because of his connections and background, was able to learn about and discover and share with the world inside information about the HARP project, a planetary geoengineering, electromagnetic, and geophysical warfare project created by the U.S. military. It's as if he was able to learn and share about the Manhattan Project before it happened. So that was the parallels are very similar between atomic weapons and the new level of ionospheric heaters represented by the HARP, was the prototype of the superheater. In that book, Nick and Gene tell us about a physicist from Princeton University, whose name I believe was Walter Richmond. And he had been studying what was happening on the Earth with humanity and the advancing juggernaut of technology. And he reckoned that, assuming that the stories and myths of ancient Atlantis had any basis in reality, that we were approaching a very similar kind of threshold of technological expertise that was allowing us to really become a threat to not only all of life on Mother Earth, but Mother Earth herself. So anyway, he didn't tell these ideas as nonfiction, because he was worried that it was going to be classified, a lot of his work. So he wrote a novel, and I believe it was called The New Millennium. But in it, just in a nutshell, I've got this book and I've read it, but it was, I can't remember the exact details. I don't have a copy in front of me. But in it, the Atlantean scientists have developed some technology, I believe using large crystals. And they were interacting with the sun, trying to manipulate the energy of the sun. And so they created what they call a solar tap, that's TAP, that enabled them to sort of create this beam that was going to draw down energy from the sun directly to the earth. There's a really cool bird singing outside my door. The solar tap was going to create this beam, a connection between the sun and the earth to bring down all this energy. But it went wrong and it backfired, and it sort of ended up bringing down a big piece of the sun into the earth's biosphere, and it burned up. It not only burned up a lot of stuff, but it also like fractured the piece of the tectonic shelf where Atlantis was, and it caused the whole region or the island to sink. So in other words, his book was a speculative foray into the events that preceded and created the sinking of the continent of Atlantis. So that's why we don't really have all that much factual information. In fact, very little, based on Plato and his teacher Solon, who apparently were friends with the ancient Egyptian priests who had been passing down this knowledge for thousands of years already at the time of the ancient Greeks. But based on, you know, I use Atlantis as the archetypal metaphor of the civilization gone wrong because of military, industrial, and technological juggernauts running off the rail and actually destroying themselves because of that. And I've wrote an article a couple of years ago called The Atlantean Discontinuity that's exactly about that same thing, about how that's exactly where we are right now. Well, what I'm getting to is that the more I look around, it seems like that we're on that threshold right now, that we're just like begging to be destroyed by the guardian beings of Mother Earth and Mother Ocean and the local heliocosm, the gods, if you want to call it that. You know, I did a recent show called that had the word Theomachy in there, which I learned from Emmanuel Wielkowski, that has to do with War of the Gods. And he also talks about how one of the things that humanity seems obsessed with, and back to the days of the ancient rulers of Mesopotamia, was that they wanted to emulate the gods. So if you look at a lot of what we're doing on a planetary and technological level, we actually are making our own, in our own sort of, cosmically it's quite feeble, but in terms of the repercussions for us and life as we know it, it's not so feeble. So we're not the gods that we'd like to think we are, but we're doing our best at an unconscious level to emulate what we've always thought of as the gods throughout human history, the forces that are greater than us, that we haven't been able to control, yet we're trying to, but that have wrought havoc on us, the gods. You know, I guess a lot of cultures had harmonious relationship with the gods, worshiped them, and they gave thanks to them. And then, you know, as long as everything was going fine, the gods were happy. But if there was natural disasters or different kind of natural or even socio-political discord, they could always blame the gods. You know, I guess it's the same outward projection of causation that underlies religious behavior and beliefs. So everywhere we turn, we see the increasingly destructive effects of engineering. And in my original geoterrorism article I wrote in March of 2011, in the wake of the Christchurch earthquake and Fukushima, I talk about how engineering is really the backbone of what we call civilization, and that civilization means living in cities. But that, going back to the ancient Sumerian city-states, it was originally a military installation. A city was also a fort that was built to, I guess, to protect people from the surrounding dangerous other competitive tribes, or to seal off and protect your resources and stuff. But it was all, civilization means living in cities that were originally built out of stone, which was the first thing that we began to dig from the land in violation of the Hopi prophecy. And I've talked about this countless times on my show. But it just keeps going further and further and further. The digging precious things from the land, and then the technological juggernaut that beat, in some ways it began with the combustion of hydrocarbons, and then it began with the generation and distribution of electricity, and then the evolution and development of computers and artificial intelligence and all this stuff. Those are some of the primary steps that have facilitated the metastasis and planetary level growth of military-industrial civilization that's allowed us to expand like a slime mold over the whole planet, which I call the Homo sapien macrovirus. And so the point of this show is to create a perspective on engineering as a form of, as the backbone of war, and war as engineering. And it's sort of like we were watching this movie called Last of the Mohicans about the French and English battling in the colonial America. And at one point, the French leader talked about how his engineers were able to progress at like 30 yards a day with the front, where they could move their cannons closer to this fort. You know, so the engineers were probably, you know, when I was a kid, the word engineer, it was the guy that drove the train. So you've got trains and cannons and all this stuff and engineering. And where I went to college in North Carolina was primarily an engineering university. So maybe that's why one of my biggest things that I learned in college was that I didn't resonate with that whole kind of field of endeavor. But it leads me to draw the comparison again between indigenous people and civilized people. And in the world of today, that boundary has become very blurred, and we're all affected by civilization. We're all inherently indigenous somewhere to begin with, but in the world of today, there can't really be many, if any, truly indigenous people. Because even if you're living in the remote highlands of Colombia or deep in the Amazon jungle, even if you've never been seen by the outsiders, these people still know. They have to be able to sense and know that everything is out there. So they're feeling these sort of morphogenetic and holographic connections with us. They're breathing some of the radio isotopes that have blown in on the air and the water and the chemicals and air pollution and the dust blowing from all the chemtrails and all that stuff. So they're still trying to be indigenous, but you know, indigenous people, whether they're First Nations, Australians, or Native Americans, people walking around with mobile phones and utes or pickup trucks and their computers and going to the pick up their money from the government and going to the grocery store and all the stuff. You can put on as much face paint as you want and play your traditional instruments, but that does not make you indigenous. Indigenous has to do with the mentality. So anybody that actually, I mean, I would go so far as to say that anybody that can speak English is not indigenous, because English is not an indigenous language. In fact, my friends and I have been talking a lot lately about how we were talking about some of the earliest European contact with indigenous people in Australia, and how a lot of the French explorers out west, like La Perouse and D'Entrecasteaux, just for two examples, their encounters with the indigenous people of Australia were very harmonious, did not result in genocide, did not result in colonialization. It's led me to wonder if that was true of the French interaction with the New World. If, in fact, the world might not be better off if we were all speaking French instead of English. Now, that's a topic for another whole story. Maybe the French are right in not speaking English and with their longstanding hostility against the English. So the word technology comes from the Greek word techne, T-E-C-H-N-E, that means the ability to make or to do. So technology is anything that allows us to make or do. And in my thinking, technology can be biological, like anything that's alive. The body and living tissues and systems and the temple for inhabitation or incarnation, that is our own biological technology as opposed to artificially created technology that we have created, like machines and computers and electronics and tools and apparatus and stuff like that. You know, so it's a complex thing. And then we've got biological technology versus artificial technology. And then in the world of today, that's kind of blurring with AI and transhumanism and all this different kind of stuff. The avatar, the enhanced human, the robotic soldier kind of thing that you see in all the James Cameron films, the Terminators. But indigenous people not only were completely biological technology, they also had an emphasis on internal technology, which is the software of our minds, to use kind of a crude metaphor. The software of our minds is our internal technology, which is why the whales and dolphins are the ultimate indigenous people, because they've got all the internal technology that we do, plus a whole lot more. Not only because their brains are more advanced than ours, but also because they've been here so much longer and they're living in completely different ways that put them in close touch with each other and with water and with the heliocosm in ways that we have no idea. But a lot of which we actually, the abilities that we have that we're just bludgeoning them out of us, or we're blocking them out with our artificial technology. But civilizations based on external technology. And this is from its very beginning. So this is kind of the points of convergence, but it's been going on for so long, for thousands of years, that our distributed mental operating environment has mutated progressively so far that now there's factions of humanity that don't even think of themselves as human anymore. And as a whole, our behavior doesn't really qualify as what human behavior has been over the millennia that we've existed. A big difference between indigenous and civilized is that what Carl Sagan called our horizon of identity, who we look out and see as us. In the world of today, the civilized person sees themselves as just their body and maybe their family, their close friends and stuff, but just me, look out for number one. But definitely our species. It doesn't go beyond our species in terms of who we are. But indigenous people looked out and saw all of life as Mitukaye Oyasin, our family of life, that we're supposed to be cared for and honor and love and not destroy. So it's really our mental operating environment is what has separated us from nature. In the beginning, it was just the beginnings of a mental attitude of superiority and dominion, and the technological ability to manipulate nature, to dig things from the land, and all the different sort of cyclical and karmic repercussions that we've set in motion that have been amplifying and feeding back, bringing us to the point now of planetary geoengineering and what you might call what's been called terraforming, but taken to the next level. Like, I've made up a new word called atmosforming that describes some of these new, well, it's actually been going on for a long time. People they're talking about with solar radiation management and the spraying of all the chemicals in the air that they want to block out the sunlight so the earth can cool because it's burning up everywhere. Well, I just have to tell you, everywhere I've been for like the past 2 months has been practically freezing. It ain't burning up down here in very southern tip of Australia or northern Tasmania. In fact, it's been far below average cold here. As Sherlock Holmes was telling us in my show from a couple of weeks ago, he reckons that the whole climate change scenario has really nothing to do with climate, only indirectly. It's a smokescreen for military-industrial geoengineering projects, as well as the concomitant largest psychological warfare operation ever to exist. These are like the mental and geophysical, the twin pillars of the modern geoengineering of the human mind and the planetary biosphere and life as we know her, which is part of the ultimate emulation of the gods project, whose name is known only to a handful of people, and it's actually an equation, the name for this top secret super project that might actually be being engineered from distant star systems or galaxies by the solid state entity communicating with us via microwaves. But that's probably not totally science fiction. But I've talked about that on other shows and will more in another upcoming show about extraterrestrial intelligence and what that actually means. But if we want to look at the driving forces of the cyclical nature, not only of long-term climate change and variations like that, of also variations in human civilization that the Hindus call the Yugas. And this ties in with the Hopi idea of the different worlds. And so if we look at, I think that Victor Klub and Bill Napier, in their article on episodic bombardment, talking about the movement of the Earth and the Sun through the different arms of the galaxies and stuff like that, that's the kind of scale on which we need to be looking at things like this. The drivers of Koyaanisqatsi. But at any rate, regardless of what those ultimate causative factors are, it's very unlikely that we're going to be able to do anything about it. Other than if we understood it and were aware of it, we might be able to not continually be victimizing ourselves because of it. So that's the reason for trying to understand all this stuff. But I really think that right now all the indicators are going off the red into the warning area in terms of our relationship with each other and with Mother Earth. And when you look at a place like where I am right now, Australia is a land of vast, vast paradoxes and contradictions. That's a guinea fowl making this sound. In terms of the ancient beauty of this land versus the horrific genocide that's not a thing of the past, and the horrific ecocide going on right now, as well as the clearly obvious signatures of geophysical warfare, the geoterrorism resulting in these massive fires all up the East Coast that are anomalous in the same way that all the fires in California are. But the paradox or the contrast of being right here now in a remote far corner of a very beautiful Gondwanaland Arc Island, and looking out onto this wind farm that's at the place of the cleanest air and water on the earth, and they're getting ready to build another larger wind farm owned by a company from China that's going to generate electricity here mainly to pump back to the mainland through the high tension power lines running through from here to Sheffield, and then a new cable they want to put in. They're calling Tasmania Australia's battery because of all the bit of surplus of hydropower that's exported, and then now with all these wind farms and stuff, this is to generate more electricity to run the artificially intelligent transhuman civilization that's exploding everywhere. And I saw a new article on Global Research about the geopolitical importance of lithium in the world today, which is what all these batteries are made from for the electric cars and stuff. So we've got the geoengineering terraforming thing going off the rail. Terraforming traditionally has talked about huge scale stuff, like I think some of the original terraforming ideas had to do with using nuclear explosions to create, blast out new harbors like Edward Teller wanted to do in Alaska, or to melt the ice caps for military and industrial purposes to help the ice to disappear so they can open shipping routes across the pole, the North Pole, and also create heat to melt the ice caps so that Antarctica's vast mineral resources can be accessed. I'm sure that that's on the agenda. So a large part of this is being driven by the HAL syndrome. HAL was the computer in 2001, A Space Odyssey, that ended up killing all of the crew except for one, except for Dave. He tried to kill Dave, and everybody thought that the computer had malfunctioned. But no, we learned that HAL was actually programmed to terminate the crew because the mission they were on, which was to try to encounter the extraterrestrial intelligence that left the big black monolith, TMA-1, on the moon, that emitted this radio signal to Jupiter. That's why they sent this craft there to begin with. And so the crew didn't really know why they were gone. And they were deemed incapable or unworthy of being the emissaries to this extraterrestrial intelligence that they hoped to meet or encounter. So they thought that the computer, HAL, was the only one capable of doing this. So that's why his programming was to eliminate the crew. So in a way, that's what all the HAL network of today is actually trying to eliminate the crew of Mother Earth, which is us and all the other life forms. We've got the whole mad science paradigm running off the rail with all these planetary geoengineering things, and the whole climate change thing. It's about manufacturing consent in the public mind for all this insane mad science stuff. But what we don't understand is that Mother Earth is not a dead chunk of rock. She's a living, breathing being that's an ancient, ancient planetary intelligence so many light years beyond us that we can't even conceive. Her intelligence is invisible to us. So while we're busy creating Frankenweather all around the whole planet, especially like here in Australia right now, where it's got record heat over most of the continent, but record cold down here in the latitudes where I've been for the past few weeks. Sure, it's not anything that nature's not capable of, because it is nature, but it's like she's being tortured. She's being tortured and forced to submit and do things that she wouldn't normally do. But only for a while. It's like this dancing bear I saw with all these chains through its nose that make it dance. But eventually it's going to gather enough strength that it can shake off these chains. I really think a lot of this stuff it's not just being run by computers, artificial intelligence, computer simulations, the global network of computers that make the HAARP network possible and all the environmental modification programs and that are driving all this stuff. But I think that we crossed the threshold a while ago, and Nick Begich actually agreed that not only can we not unplug it even if we wanted to, that also it's got a mind of its own, that we may actually be under attack from the solid state entity that Dr. John Lilly talked about, that all these radio telescopes receiving all these microwaves and stuff, there may be top secret projects that have been bringing down information that's feeding into the global computer network that's telling it what to do. I'd sort of jokingly satirized this in my article about Elon Musk buying the U.S. military to wage war on climate change, but there could be some truth to it. So it could be that the whole NMOD geophysical warfare paradigm is being run by computers, but possibly for its own agenda. I had a vision the other night that Mother Ocean as a whole, the spherical body of Mother Ocean on the planet, as a being, a planetary being, and she is actually aware of and under attack from the solid state electronic extraterrestrial intelligence that's trying to take over life on land with all the electrical grid and the microwaves and everything. And she's very aware of that, and the whales and dolphins are right in the middle of this. They're like the emissaries between Mother Ocean and us and life on the land. They're aware of what's going on and trying to tell us and speaking through people like me that are aware on these wavelengths. But it's been such an honor to be here in this very remote area. There's no microwaves here. I do have phone signal, but it's one of the cleanest environments I've ever been in. And it's so ironic that they're going to put up these wind turbines to generate more electricity, that if we just conserved more, we wouldn't need any new sources of electricity to maintain our current levels of living. But it's not about that. It's about growth, the unbridled expansion. But it's all going to come to an end soon, I think. It can't keep going on. If we become the tyrant of the earth, in the words of Joseph Wood Crutch. Well, I better go for now. I've got to pack up and go over to the Bay of Fires, camp out for a few days before I then go down to Hobart and back to the mainland and then to New Zealand in about 3 weeks. This has been one of my most beautiful and fantastic visits to Australia. I've met so many new people and seen a lot of old friends and gone to some beautiful new places, and trying to do my best to bring forth a new dreaming and to help everybody be inspired to be on their highest path and to ask more of themselves. And I'd like to thank the guinea fowl for talking to us there, Mother Teoa for coming up. And this is a very rare, beautiful, clear morning here with no wind. Oh my God, it's been so windy here. Craig's out fishing, and it's going to be a beautiful day. We have so much to be thankful for. Anyway, this is Jeff Phillips Wefferson signing off for On the Brink Radio, broadcast number 302. Many thanks to Jules Stanley, UCY-TV, Mitikaya Yas, and all the Star Nations and all the whales and dolphins. Kia Manuia. May all beings be peaceful. May all beings be happy.
Good night.